Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
Hello. Hi.
You seem surprised that... Hello? Hello?
I didn't realise I was here.
Oh, dear. Well, what have you been up to this week?
Nothing. Me and my daughter are not very well, so...
I'll join you in that sentiment as well. I'm also not very well.
I fought off the bug and now we've both got a cold.
Always a fun way to spend a week. Mm. Well, seeming as you've done nothing, I will let you know what I've been doing. My legs are killing me because I went up onto Dartmoor. And
Oh, yes.
It was a nice day, actually. It was one heck of a trek. So, yes, I was up onto Dartmoor, trekking along to try and find the source of the River Tor, which is not actually that hard to find. It's pretty much listed on most maps. So it wasn't exactly into the heart of darkness or anything, but it was certainly a trek up onto a place where the conditions change unbelievably quickly. I mean, I know that, you know, that is said, and it is very, very true. I went up there in blazing sunshine, so much so that I was thinking, oh, I will take my coat off. Before I'd even had chance to actually sort of action that thought of, I will take my coat off. The sky grew grey. And then by the time I'd actually got about as far as I could go, it had been raining on and off pretty heavily for the last couple of days before Saturday. The whole area was just absolutely, you know, boggy ground. There were rivers of water running everywhere up on the higher ground. I got as far as I could go before I thought, well, I'm not going to go wading through this river, which at this point is still relatively large. To get to the other side of the path, to go wandering up for another mile or two to find the very, very source of the river, which is actually just by like a stone. It's on a patch of boggy ground up higher on the hill, which denotes where the River Tor starts. So I thought, okay, I'll turn back. Don't want to get my feet wet. Don't want to get my boots wet. Started heading back, and of course it then started to chuck it down so hard and so much that by the end of it, my feet were soaked anyway, so it wouldn't have made much difference if I had gone wandering through. The only difference is I'd have been in a snowstorm higher up on Dartmoor than I'd have wanted to, because it started to snow and hail as well. It was, yeah,
Jesus.
All seasons in one day that day. So
yeah,
it was a good walk. It was about 8 miles in total, but my legs are killing me after that.
We saw a lot of snow, but we didn't go and enjoy it.
I'm not one for snow. I don't tend to enjoy it in the first place, but
I love snow.
It doesn't stick long enough around here anyway. It's got to properly snow for that to happen. Other than that, Aaron, I don't think I've been doing much else. I've tried and unsuccessfully tried to 3D print some fish. That didn't go well.
No.
In fact, just before we came on to recording for this, I had just checked my 3D printer thinking, oh, brilliant. It was about 60% done printing a trout. I know that sounds really odd, but it's something I've been meaning to do for a while. And it had stopped actually printing and was just doing nothing in the air. So me and 3D printers, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And this was one of those times where it didn't. It was just causing me stress for no reason today. So, yeah, well, if you've not been up to much, and I've gone and walked a million miles, it felt like a million miles. Let's head on into the news, shall we?
Let's do it.
Mm.
It's the news!
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, take it away.
Every week, we are inundated with news coming out of the weird and wonderful world of natural sciences. And though we are but a small team, we want you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, to be kept up to date on the good, the bad, and the extraordinary. So let's open up our natural history cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive on in. So our first article comes to us from fizz.org, and the headline is, Female North Atlantic right whales growing smaller, leading to fewer births. So this is a team of Scottish and US oceanologists studying North Atlantic right whales found that females are not reaching the expected sizes that they should be, leading to fewer births and increased risk of extinction. At just 356 individuals left, the North Atlantic right whale is the most endangered of the right whales. And scientists believe the reduction in size may be down to decreased prey populations as a result of climate change, making foraging much more difficult.
Well, staying in the water, although you may want to sort of move out of the way, because my first one comes from The Guardian. Humpback sex photographed for the first time, but both whales were male. So you wouldn't want to be in the middle of any sort of whale mating going on, but it would appear that for the first time, humpback whales have been observed having sex. But the interesting and landmark moment, as it's been described, was in fact two whales. The two whales were male. This was actually a sighting confirmed by scientists in January 2022 in the waters west of the island of Maui, where the two whales approached and circled the boat before engaging in sexual activity about 3 to 5 meters below the vessel. Both whales were male. It's really hard to say whales were male. It's a hell of a tongue twister, that one. Which makes the photographs the first evidence of homosexuality in humpback whales. I mean, it doesn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form. It's almost a non-news article, apart from the fact that it's the first time that humpbacks have been observed having sex. So there you go.
Yeah, well, we're sticking in the water even longer. And this time you really will want to get out of the way. Because coming to us from Live Science, I could have been cruel for laughing, but a 16-foot-long shark bites stranded pygmy whale's head off as humans to rescue it.
That reminds me of, I think it's a clip of someone like rescuing a small bird, releasing it, and a bird of prey just annihilates it as soon as they release it.
Yes. And when people pick up spiders because they don't want them in their homes, but they don't want them in their homes, but they're brave enough to pick them up and kind enough to put them into a bush and like hope for the best. And then some like robin comes along and swipes the spider. But yeah, people are trying to do a good deed, which is an admirable and courageous thing to do. But right when they're about to win, someone else comes along and ruins it. So a stranded pygmy sperm whale was one-shotted by a great white shark in waist-high water along the New Zealand coast. The event took place on Hawke's Bay on the Mahia Peninsula and occurred as people were trying to rescue the whale.
Please tell me there's video footage of this.
I didn't see the video footage. There was pictures, but I didn't see the video footage.
I just really want to see a great white in waist-deep water. I'm just
imagining that they're trying to push, like a group of people trying to push this whale back to deeper water, and then out of nowhere, slam, the head is just gone.
Oh, well, fair enough. Well, if anything, just to sort of balance things out, a solitary killer whale has been filmed hunting and killing a great white shark in what's called an astonishing attack. This happened in South Africa. It's the first time that they've been recorded doing it solitary. Usually it's a couple of whales that will immobilize a shark, open it up like a can of beans, and just feast on their liver. Orcas are incredibly impressive animals when it comes to doing that, to the point where the great white sharks in and around their normal spots around like Cape Town and that, they've all cleared off because the orcas are there. Blame them. So, yeah, it's an unprecedented attack by a highly skilled individual that has learned to do this on its own.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I'm going to drag us out of the water temporarily and potentially to the skies, because Science Daily is reporting on the hidden rule for flight feathers and how it could reveal which dinosaurs could fly. So after examining hundreds of birds in museum collections, researchers have found an array of characteristics shared by all flying birds, shedding light on how dinosaurs first evolved bird-like flight and which dinosaurs would have been capable of achieving flight in the first place. The study further supports the notion that Archaeopteryx was at least flight-ready, sharing the same traits outlined as rules for feathered flight.
So you may remember a couple of weeks ago, I was telling you about a Japanese macaque that had escaped from a zoo in Scotland, the Highland Wildlife Park.
Yeah.
Well, they escaped. Did we go over the fact that he was recaptured?
I don't think we did. I don't think we did.
Maybe we did. He was recaptured relatively easily. Honshu, as he's called, the Japanese macaque, is actually being set to be moved to a brand new location. This is part of a new mini troop after spending 5 days roaming the Highlands. He's actually going to be moved to Edinburgh Zoo. So part of the same Royal Zoological Society of Scotland's collection, just this time in Edinburgh. So it would appear that they are breaking up the troop and making it a bit more manageable and sending them to Edinburgh Zoo. And he's going to be one of the macaques that will get a fresh start at Edinburgh Zoo. So a definite good result for him all around. He had a bit of time out, and he's now getting a slightly easier group by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's cool. And that wraps it up for this week's newsreel installment. Remember, if you guys have hope...
If you have hope, there is none.
If you guys have hope... No, remember that if you guys have news articles and topics of interest that you think we should cover, send them in and send us your hope that we can get through any of this without coughing. You can use any of the usual ways of contacting us. You might even try coughing to us in Morse code. And you might see a chosen topic or news article covered here or in the main topic discussion. And with that said, it's my turn this week, and I'm going to drag you back into the water, but this time... Instead of the crystalline azure seas and oceans of the world, I'm taking you into the murky depths of the Amazon. And this article comes to us from Mongo Bay. And the headline is, New Giant Anaconda Species Found on Waorani Indigenous Land in Ecuador. So scientists have published the exciting discovery of a new species of anaconda. The species, named the northern green anaconda, scientific name is Eunectes acayima, was found in part of the Ecuadorian Amazon rainforest and is genetically distinct from its close relative, the green anaconda, which is Eunectes murinus, and may now be the largest snake species in the world. Anaconda blood samples have historically been collected for study, and one such yield from a collection in 2022 for significant information. This particular batch originated from the Bamino region of the Bahuari Waorani territory in Ecuador. Sorry if I'm butchering these names. Sorry about that. And to obtain samples from across the Green Anaconda Range, researchers had to brave challenging conditions and traverse difficult environmental obstacles. But when entering this specific territory, they did so with the morale boost of having the express permission of the Waorani leader, Penti Bahua. In fact, the identification of this species was only made possible with the aid of the Waorani people, in particular their guides, who led a 10-day expedition into the local forest searching for the snakes, considered sacred to the Waorani peoples. Genetic analyses of the samples collected from the Waorani's land yielded the most exciting discovery, the distinction between anacondas of this territory and those found beyond it. A genetic difference of 5.5% represents a larger difference than that found between us and our closest ape cousins, which is only 2%. This 5.5% difference, described as staggering by the team, clearly separates it from the previously better known species, the green anaconda. These are, or were, the largest snakes in the world until now. Estimates have these snakes reaching weights in excess of 54 kilograms and lengths between 16 to 19 foot. sometimes pushing slightly bigger. But this new species revealed individuals pushing up to 21 foot. However, the indigenous peoples report on much larger specimens being observed. But this species may well have gone the way of so many before it, being discovered only after its own extinction. The species exists in incredibly low population densities and an increasingly small range, more threatened by human influence and the change that brings than their more widespread cousins are. Of particular concern is the effect of oil spills upon their fertility and reproductive biology. And combating this is the seemingly eternal battle fought by the Waiorani people against oil drillers, miners, and loggers, all of whom have been trying to poach the land from local indigenous peoples. The Waiorani people themselves won a lawsuit recently after communities were coerced off of their land by international oil auctioning. That pretty much sums up the article in itself. It's a little bit of an older article, being about 2 weeks, or possibly even 3 weeks old. But and also it's an article from a listener, Jake, who sent this in to me. The reason why I wanted to hold on to it until an episode where I was doing the main topic is because one of the things that I like about anacondas, particularly green anacondas, is the mythology that surrounds them. Victorian explorers were always saying that they found these massive long snakes, even longer than what these ones were at. Like, there's records of them being up to, anecdotal records of them being up to beyond 30 foot, which rivals the longest snake in the world, which is the reticulated python, and even records of them pushing 60 foot, which is quite unbelievable. But my point is that they were at least right in the sentiment that there is a bigger anaconda out there waiting to be found. And as we've
always a bigger fish,
there's always a bigger fish, or in this case, always a bigger boa. The more we've pushed into the rainforest, either by destroying it or by going into study, as is the case here, the more we found, the more we discovered. So I actually, whereas before, like the idea of larger anacondas being around, it's always like a, you know, Victorian explorer's tall tale. However, when the indigenous say that they're larger specimens out there, and we've just found a completely new species of them that are bigger, noticeably bigger, I lean in on saying that I do believe the indigenous people that this species may in fact have bigger specimens yet to be found.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's scope there for these things to be there, although the sort of scale of them being, you know, the giants of which the Victorians talk about.
The 60-foot monsters. I don't believe in that, no.
No. But always interesting to have a new species.
Yeah.
Even if it is one that is now almost instantly threatened, but that just seems to be the way of the world.
Yeah, but like I say, at least it was found before it went extinct, because quite a lot of the time we find species after they've gone. This one we can do something about, hopefully.
Are there any efforts to now see if any of them are already in collections, you know, being described as something else?
So it mentioned some of the things that, not some of the things, it mentioned that now they're going to work towards protecting it and that area a bit better, and that the indigenous do protect them. It also, it highlighted that these snakes are sacred to them. However, it didn't mention if there are any in any collections, or if indeed they're going to go looking at in collections, which you'd think would be a good place to go and have a look.
Yeah, I would assume that there's probably some in collections at some place somewhere in the world, just labeled incorrectly, that, you know, we would potentially have that backup population of them to then hold on to into zoos. And and essentially do what has been done with giraffes over the last 5-6 years now of
try and split the species, you know,
resplitting them as a group and reorganizing giraffes in collections the world over to benefit what we now know about their subspecies and genetic diversity, and yeah, change what we have. So it'd be interesting to see that, and I imagine there's probably going to be more to follow that.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Well, shall we move out of our rather watery, damp news and head into a somewhat drier creature feature?
Yes.
It's the creature feature.
Right, well, we're into this week's creature feature. And this week, we are going to take a trip back to the Jurassic. Now, I know that this is two dinosaurs in two consecutive weeks. However, we may be on the same continent of North America. However, we are, in fact, in a time period long before your terrible claw, Aaron, which was from last week. We are, in fact, in the Jurassic period and probably the singular most famous formation of the Jurassic, the Morrison Formation, home to such household dinosaur names as Allosaurus, Diplodocus, and of course, this week's main feature, Brachiosaurus. For everyone other than Aaron, I'm currently joined by a lovely Brachiosaurus toy, which is right next to me, a big Jurassic World one that is quite tall, actually.
It's a very nice one.
It is. So he's going to be sat here peering in at me the entire time I do this. But Brachiosaurus, being this week's creature feature, stands out as one of the most recognizable sauropods that you probably have heard of. And there's probably only one other sauropod that people may be able to name more than that, and that's most likely Brontosaurus. But we won't go into that at this point as to whether, you know, it's the Brontosaurus you're thinking of or not the Brontosaurus you're thinking of. That's a whole other kettle of fish, and I'm not even going to go there.
You have PTSD with a particular brontosaur incident that I was witness to as well. This is a very deep cut, but around the time that this podcast started, if not a little bit before, we were building a base on Ark and Atta hit a wild brontosaur, which then...
I forgot those were brontosaurs in that game.
It then tore apart the base that Gareth had spent hours building.
Yes, it did. And now I am, yep, just reliving that moment in my head. Thank you very much, Aaron. So let's start off our Brachiosaurus feature. We know this animal relatively well because of its very noticeable body shape. As I've already mentioned, it's a sauropod, which are the long-necked dinosaurs. And it lived in America during the late Jurassic period, roughly 154 to 150 million years ago. In the Morrison Formation, this is in Western North America, in what would have been at that point Laramidia, the island continent bit. North America becomes split in two halves, Laramidia and Appalachia. But to give you an idea of where this animal potentially roamed, using modern US states and where the Morrison Formation itself actually extends today, you will find that it's in a huge area covering Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, a little bit of Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Idaho. So it's basically this big blob.
There's some overlap there with Deinonychus, but like you say, they're separated by a lot of time.
Yes, distinctly. Yeah, I mean, they're both on that same part of Laramidia. So the environment that this rock layer sets out is a semi-arid environment with distinct wet seasons, flat open floodplains, and it would have been, I suppose, akin to something like northwestern Australia, perhaps, or the skeleton coast of Africa, where it's, you know, dry for a good chunk of the year. But then when the wet season hits, it hits, and the place becomes totally and utterly different to what it was just a few weeks previous. Now, living in this environment as well, we would have also come across species of sauropods other than Brachiosaurus, including some other relatively famous species. You would have come across Barosaurus, Camarasaurus, as well as Supersaurus as well. So some fairly well-known Jurassic era sauropods. Now, this environment was also full of other giants, not just the sauropods. You were probably, if you were to go on safari there, you would find Stegosaurus, Othnelia, Camptosaurus, those famous herbivores of the time. And hunting them were things like Ceratosaurus, Ornitholestes, Porvosaurus, and the king of the Jurassic, Allosaurus, and the even bigger and just as impressive Saurophaganax as well. These big carnivorous dinosaurs would have obviously been hunting pretty much anything and everything in the environment. Now, amongst them on the ground floor, you'd have come across some little oddities as well, mammals or proto-mammals, frogs, reptiles, turtles, even cynephrodons, similar to modern-day tuataras, and various different types of crocodile relatives, crocodilomorphs, with loads of pterosaurs overhead. So this was a very productive area and environment that, well, we know an awful lot of because there is an awful lot of material found in the Morrison Formation, and it is very well studied as well. Some of the plants in this environment wouldn't look too out of place today. You would see things like ginkgos, cycads, and conifers. They would look very much out of place today in places like South Dakota and Utah. however, they would not have looked out of place, well, in tropical parts of the world today. Monkey puzzles and various other members of the Araucaria genus, and we've talked about them when we've talked about the Wollemi pine. You would have also seen a good amount of ferns, tree ferns, and all sorts of ground-covering plants as well, like horsetails, closer to the boggy marshes of rivers and that. So, you know, a fairly jam-packed environment, very seasonal, but full of some true giant and truly iconic dinosaurs as well. So the discovery of this species was in the 1900s. It was found in an area called the Bushy Basin member of the Morrison Formation. The type of rock that it was found in, essentially, so the Bushy Basin member, which I think is a brilliant name, very similar in age to the Kimmeridgian, which you would know, Aaron, from, well, basically around here. It's the Kimmeridge clays, which are from Dorset and from Devon.
Yep.
It was found in rocks that, like I say, dated between 154 and 153 million years ago, and found by an American paleontologist, Elmer S. Riggs, and his team from the Field Columbian Museum, which was the old name for what is now known as the Chicago Field Museum. So quite a famous institute for finding things. Riggs was sent out as a result between some correspondence between himself and a dentist, Stanton Merrill Banbury, who lived in the nearby Grand Junction area. And in the spring of 1899, Briggs sent letters to various mayors in western Colorado, inquiring after the possible trails leading from railways into northeastern Utah, where he hoped to find some fossils from the Eocene. Just basically asking what people had come across on a lot of these different paths and trails that had been cut into the countryside over the years of, the gold rush and different things like that. He didn't find any Eocene mammals. In fact, to his surprise, he was informed by Bradbury, the dentist, who was in himself an amateur fossil hunter, of some dinosaur bones that he'd been collecting near Grand Junction since 1885. Riggs was skeptical, of course, about these claims, but his curator, George Oliver Cummings, was very eager to add large sauropods to his collection. We're right in the middle of that period of paleontology in North America where essentially the bone wars were taking place. All the institutes wanted to obviously have their own big next ticket item to get people to come through the doors. You know, it was that period of sort of rapid arms race paleontology, which I've got to admit, if you could go back in time and see, that would probably be quite interesting to see what was going on. They all wanted to have the biggest, the baddest, the best, that sort of thing. So during this prospecting trip, he was able to actually find the humerus of a Brachiosaurus, saying it was the biggest thing yet. He actually took it at first look for a badly preserved Brontosaurus specimen and gave priority to excavating it, but later realized it was actually a new species. And this is where it becomes a bit interesting, because the actual amount of bits of Brachiosaurus that we have is remarkably little. Like with most dinosaur finds, it is basically down to what we can piece together. Now, thankfully, sauropods do tend to preserve relatively well because most of their bones are mohusive, and Brachiosaurus is no exception. But the holotype specimen, the one that the name was given to, actually consists of only a right humerus, that's the upper arm bone, the right femur, which is the thigh bone, the right ilium, which is the hip bone, the coracoid bone, which is your shoulder bone, the sacrum, which are fused vertebrae in and around the hips, and the last seven thoracic vertebrae, some caudal vertebrae, and several ribs. There's also a little bit of skull that was found later on, but that's pretty much it. A remarkably small amount of material for such a large and iconic dinosaur. But Riggs's report was published in 1901 about his findings, noting that the unusual length of the humerus compared to the femur gave an overall size and proportions a lot like a giraffe. Longer arms at the front, smaller legs at the back. However, at the time, he didn't publish a name for this new dinosaur, and it took until 1903 for it to eventually be given the type species name of Brachiosaurus ultrathorax. The name comes from the Greek arm lizard, brachio or brachios, and lizard, obviously, from sauros. Now, an ultrathorax comes from basically wide chest cavity. That's because, well, these guys do have a huge sort of big chest. Now, diet for our lovely Brachiosaurus. It's obviously no surprise that Brachiosaurs would be eating plants. They're not exactly the sort of animal that would be chasing you down like a T-Rex. This is an animal that is built for grazing and built for grazing up high. If you look at the arms of a Brachiosaur, it is very different in proportions to that of most other sauropods, which gives it a really unique posture, meaning that it would be a specialized high browser like giraffes are today, meaning that it doesn't have to compete with stuff below it. Now, Brachiosaurus would have been feeding on things like, ginkgos, conifers, pretty much any and all the plants that would have been growing at this height in the Morrison Formation. It would have been eating this plant matter with its almost spoon-shaped teeth, which would have been used for nipping off, stripping branches, and swallowing the leaves whole. Like all other sauropods, it didn't have molars. It didn't chew its food. These guys swallowed their stuff whole. Basically, think a wood chipper but without the chipping part, until you get further down into its stomach, where it had gastroliths, which are large rocks that the animal would have swallowed, and do all the grinding and crushing work for it in the animal's gut. And we know that they had these because when we find sauropod remains, we quite often find these highly polished stones in where the chest cavity or where the stomach cavity would be for these animals. Now, every now and again, I see ridiculous arguments put forward by young Earth creationists and various people from the groups that I'm not entirely sure whether they're real or satire or whatever. Things like Christians Against Dinosaurs, which I'm still not entirely sure whether that's a real thing or whether it's parody. Either way,
I think unfortunately, it's real.
Probably, yeah. The argument usually goes that these animals would have been so large that there is no way on earth that they could have been able to eat enough food to have survived or maintained its body size. This comes from a fundamental lack of understanding of the size of a brachiosaur and its head. The argument usually goes that their head is so tiny that they wouldn't have been able to eat enough food to be able to maintain that massive body size. Well, to give you an idea of just how big a Brachiosaurus's head is, it is actually small compared to its body. But compare it to something like a human. Aaron, if you wouldn't mind balling yourself up into the fetal position, you'd basically be about the size of a Brachiosaurus's head.
Oh, okay.
So, in fact, for our listeners at home, if you want to, you know, ball yourself into the fetal position,
your homework,
you can, yeah, you can be a Brachiosaurus head. That's actually quite large.
Yoga with the Natural History Cupboard.
Exactly. So it's relatively large in in comparison to something like a human, but obviously compared to the body of a Brachiosaurus, which is something close to 40 tons in weight and four stories tall, that's comparatively small. But that is big enough to be able to take in a normal day's worth of food for it. Now, to break it down, a 40-ton animal like this feeding for 16 hours a day, biting off between a tenth and two-thirds of a kilo of plant matter, taking between one and six bites per minute, its daily food intake would have been roughly the equivalent of 1.5% of its entire body weight. And that is comparable in size and sort of intake-wise to a modern-day elephant. So not exactly what you'd call groundbreaking or earth-shatteringly fast. And these are animals that obviously didn't move massively fast. But it doesn't take much if you're an animal with a neck like that to park up in between a bunch of trees and just rotate yourself every now and again just to nibble on a new bunch of trees. And because you are higher than everything else, there's nothing else that's competing with you except maybe another brachiosaur. So, not exactly what you would call earth-shatteringly strange science there. Just because you don't understand the science doesn't mean that it isn't true. Now, another misconception about Brachiosaurus that has been suggested is that it could have reared up on its hind legs, which we see in the opening scenes of Jurassic Park, where you actually see the Brachiosaurus for the first time. However, using its tail for sort of ground support, they've actually worked this out fairly recently using physical modeling techniques, skeletal analysis, and showed that whereas a lot of other sauropods would have had the skeletal capabilities to have reared up and would have actually worked out more efficient for them in some cases because their heads are closer to the ground, Brachiosaurus is already up quite high. It would have only added about 33% more feeding height comparable to that of other sauropods. So it's not very worth it. Also, with the mass and the weight of their front portion of their body, it would have actually overweighed them quite a bit too much. Their tail wouldn't have been able to support it, and their back legs wouldn't have been able to go with the large stresses and forces that that weight would have put on them. So they simply weren't built to be able to do that. So unfortunately, that really iconic scene in the beginning of Jurassic Park just would not have happened, which is sad, I know. So it's at this point, Aaron, we have to take a look at a close cousin of our lovely Brachiosaurus. In fact, at one point, this is an animal that was considered Brachiosaurus, and that is its, African cousin, which nowadays is called Giraffatitan branchii. However, not too long ago was referred to as Brachiosaurus branchii. And that is due to the fact that these two species do look very similar to each other. So much so that, in fact, because the lack of Brachiosaurus material and the overwhelming majority of Giraffatitan material, you'll find that the two often get mistaken for each other. So much so that this lovely Brachiosaurus model that I'm holding in my hands is most likely a Giraffatitan. Because what we see as Brachiosaurus in popular media is what we see as Brachiosaurus in most popular media is actually Giraffatitan. And that's because the two have been so long confused with each other. If you're looking at a Brachiosaurus toy, you're probably looking at a Giraffatitan. You just didn't know it. So we have to figure out the differences between these two very, very similar animals. Brachiosaurus and Giraffatitan were both considered at one point to be basically the same animal, but just different species. They were considered to be sister taxa. However, this is very different nowadays. And it's taken a bit of time to unwind them in the popular consciousness. To give you an idea of these animals themselves, one comes from North America, Morrison Formation, Brachiosaurus, and the other one comes from what is called the Tanguru Formation in Tanzania. Now, both are from the late Jurassic period, from about 150 million years ago. One is from obviously West North America, and the other one is from Tanzania. And it is obviously Giraffa Titan that is from Tanzania and was discovered by a German paleontologist by the name of Werner von Eigen. I think I may have got that right or wrong. I'm not sure, actually. But who he basically led what is probably one of the most and still most impressive largest dinosaur digs in human history. In 1909 and through to 1913, he extracted hundreds and hundreds of bones and brought them back to Germany. And by far the most spectacular of these was Brachiosaurus. At the time, it was called that. You can now see it mounted in the Natural History Museum in Berlin. And because both of these bones look very similar, Brachiosaurus and Giraffa Titan, they basically got absorbed into one. And the idea of Giraffa Titan being Brachiosaurus comes from the fact that so much more material was taken out of Tanzania by the German paleontologists, that it basically shaped our idea of what Brachiosaurus is, so much so that it overwhelms the actual animal. But the information about these animals have changed over time. And it was in the late 1980s that Gregory S. Paul, an American paleontologist, actually called attention to how different the two specimens were. And he decided that they'd be better off putting Giraffa Titan under a subgenus as opposed to being in the exact same genus, starting the split between the two. Now, in 2009, Mike Taylor took a really rigorous look at all of the bones and compared as many of them as possible between the two specimens and found that there were major differences in all of them, which led him to conclude that Giraffa Titan is actually a separate genus entirely, not just a subgenus, but a completely separate genus. And then in 2012, a paleontologist coded them separately using a phylogenetic tree, which is looking at the closest ancestors and physical or genetic traits that the animals have. And it puts them in very, very different places. In fact, Brachiosaurus is more closely related to some of the Cretaceous species of sauropod than it is to Giraffa Titan, which makes sense. They're from two different parts of the planet. They just happen to do very, very similar things and look very similar. So the difference between the two are relatively minor, but they are distinct enough. Brachiosaurus has a much longer torso, about a quarter that, and a tail longer by about a fifth to a quarter of Giraffa Titan. So stretch it out a little bit longer than what you would imagine a Brachiosaurus to be, and you've now got a Brachiosaurus. Its shoulder sockets point outwards, as opposed to Giraffa Titans, which are more standard and downward-facing shoulder joints. So think of Brachiosaurus as having that sort of buff chest sort of sticking out a bit more. It's got the bulldog arms, I suppose would be the way of putting it. Both have really slender, long forearms, although Brachiosaurus is a bit more robust. They're a bit chunkier, which leads us to conclude that Brachiosaurus was probably carrying more of its weight over its arms than Giraffa Titan was. So it's doing that whole, gorilla walk, I suppose, almost. So I'm using gorillas and bulldogs to obviously talk about a Giraffa Titan and a Brachiosaurus. A weird comparison, I know. But yeah, they are really similar animals, and they look very, very similar. And that's because of a really interesting bit of evolution and also the way that animals take advantage of niches in their environment. Now, at this point, Pangaea was breaking up, and you end up with a lot of animals in areas very similar to each other. And that's exactly what we see in Africa at this point, in the Tenguru formation, and in the Morrison formation in North America. We see animals that are very similar. There are sauropods, obviously, just like our lovely Brachiosaurus. We have Giraffa Titan. We have mid-level sauropods like Camarasaurus. We also have things like Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus. You've got stegosaurs in North America. You've got Stegosaurus. And then in the Tenguru formation, you have got Kentrosaurus. So very similar and doing the same sort of thing. You've got small herbivorous dinosaurs as well, doing the exact same job. You've even got things like Allosaurus and a, well, at the moment, I believe it's still considered an allosaur, but there are loads and loads of very, very similar ecological niches being filled by very, very similar looking dinosaurs. Now, that doesn't mean that they're related to each other. It just means that there's been such a little amount of time between these land masses basically breaking apart and becoming their own separate entities that no animal has really had enough time to evolve to the point of being completely different in how it does things. So everything is very similar. And this is what's called endemism. It's a process that basically points out how different a habitat is compared to another habitat. And if you look at that part of Africa today and you compare it to that part of North America today, you'll see there is a drastic difference in the habitats and the animals that live in them. So yeah, it's a really interesting thing to look at. And we see the same sort of thing repeating all over the globe, even today, with different animals that are closely related to each other in time, but obviously unrelated to each other in nature. To finish up this creature feature about Brachiosaurus, I wanted to go and dive into the sort of pop culture side of things. We haven't had a real pop culture moment for a while, Aaron.
No, we haven't actually.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out that obviously the popular depiction of Brachiosaurus most likely is Giraffatitan, as with this one here. But that doesn't mean that it's any less of an animal. So for the purposes of this, yes, we are calling it Brachiosaurus. It's made it into various different types of media. It's a very iconic animal, and I would find it hard for you to find a dinosaur documentary that doesn't feature the Morrison Formation and doesn't have a Brachiosaurus in it. So much so that there is even an asteroid named Brachiosaurus in honor of this dinosaur, which is a bit of an odd one. In cinema history, it's probably most famous and iconic scene that it has ever turned up with. Is the absolutely groundbreaking at the time, and I'd still say holds up really well. Opening moments of Jurassic Park. It's the first dinosaur that you properly see that is completely CGI. It is that particular scene is responsible for some of the Emmys and Oscars or whatever that Jurassic Park won at the time. To get
That scene still gives me goosebumps when you first touch down and see the Brachiosaur every
yeah.
time.
Unfortunately, I've now ruined the fact that it can't stand up on its back legs. But the way that they actually modeled the animal, its gait, and how it moved, they gave it the gait of a giraffe, obviously
That's
with
right.
proportions. But they gave the rig, the computer model, the mass of an elephant, so it would have the right amount of weight when it moved as well. Now, this is where we cross over a little bit. Something that you into an area, Aaron, that I feel you would like more than Jurassic Park.
I know where you're going with it. I think I know where you're going
You
with
probably already know where I'm going
this.
with this, but in the 1997 digital remaster of Star Wars: A New Hope, the Ronto, which
Ronto,
are
that's
those,
right.
they can't come from Tatooine. I can't remember where they come from, but it can't be
I think they are native to Tatooine.
a really long-necked animal living on a planet with no plants to eat. That says to me they don't live there.
This is going on a bit of a tangent now, but the Tatooine wasn't
No,
is
I
like
know.
it was
But
a lush planet that got glassed by the Empire.
not by the Empire,
No, the ones
the
before, the Sith
Republican Empire.
Empire.
Yeah. However, that animal should have died out then because there's nothing for it to eat. But in the 1997 remaster of Star Wars: A New Hope, in the Mos Eisley scene, you see a Ronto rearing up as I think it's a
That's
speeder
right.
comes past at too fast. That was essentially a reskinned Brachiosaurus from Jurassic Park.
That is correct.
I have a feeling you might have known that one, but I felt it had to go in there anyway because it's an animal that I'm going to call it Space Brachiosaurus. That is Brachiosaurus for you. It's an animal that I've always liked. I mean, I know I say this about a lot of dinosaurs, but it's always been one of my favorites. When I had the I think it's the Natural History Museum's toys that
Is
they have.
that the green one?
The green one. It was my favorite one. My brother had the Diplodocus. I had the Brachiosaurus. And that was by far my favorite.
I've managed to recover, thanks to my mum, I've managed to recover the Diplodocus, but that Brachiosaurus is still somewhere in their house.
And you know what? I love the fact that through, I believe it was Facebook Marketplace, I was able to buy this Jurassic World one for my son, and he loves it as well. Probably not as much as I love it. I think I enjoy it far more than he does, just having it stand there in the corner of the room, just looking at you with a slightly derpy look that only a toy dinosaur can really have, that has its mouth hang open every now and again. There is Brachiosaurus. It's a stunning animal. I could have gone far more into its life history and its interactions with other animals in the Morrison Formation. But it is worth knowing the fact that this animal is, for the longest time, has been a completely different animal. It's been Giraffatitan. But either way, both of them are really cool. So let's move from our creature feature, shall we, Aaron? And head into the formation that is our... Well, you go on then.
So just really quickly, you mentioned like some of the pop culture there with like Jurassic Park and that. Did you mention that it's one of only very few Jurassic dinosaurs in that franchise?
Actually, you know what? I didn't, but that's a very good point.
It's one of very, very, very few Titan, whichever dinosaurs. You want to call it.
Yeah, it's one of only a very few dinosaurs that is actually Jurassic. In fact, it's the only one in the first film that is a Jurassic dinosaur. Everything else is
continued.
The only other ones that appear in any of the Jurassic franchises that are Jurassic would be the Stegosaurs and the Compsognathus in the second film. The third film has no Jurassic dinosaurs.
Dilophosaurus is an early Jurassic one as
sorry.
Well.
Dilophosaurus, yeah, sorry, that would be the only other one. I completely forgot about Dilophosaurus.
But still, that's still very, for a franchise called Jurassic Park, it's still very, very few Jurassic dinosaurs.
Well, whilst we think about that, should we head on into our emails for this week?
Let's do it.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right, well, we're into our emails for this week. A bit of sad news to report, Aaron. No one answered last week's question, which was what natural history-based event are you off to? So evidently no one's off to anything at the moment. Which is fine. You know, it can be hit and miss with these things sometimes. So I don't have any comments to read out. Makes my life a little easier, I suppose, but it makes the podcast that little bit less full. Oh, well. To make things a little bit more, shall we say, interaction friendly for this coming week, because we have been dinosaur heavy these last 2 weeks, both of which are North American dinosaurs as well, and because it is generally where most people's favorite dinosaurs tend to lie, because, well, let's face it, they're the dinosaurs that have become the most famous for some of the largest and some of the first properly well-known dinosaurs in the world. So this week's question is a simple one. What is your favorite North American dinosaur? Aaron, what's your favorite North American dinosaur?
Well, there's a few contenders.
I'm going to take a guess here. Is it T-Rex?
Ultimately, yes, it's probably T-Rex. But they, I mean, you've got Deinonychus and Triceratops that both are very, 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 very close.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, the list is quite long. It's two contenders in my mind, really, in a lot of ways. Brachiosaurus being one, mm-hmm. because it is just...
That's another good one.
Pretty damn cool. But I'm also quite fond of Utah Raptor. Utah Raptor, I think, has been one of those dinosaurs that really spoke to me when it was, you know, it was coming out. A lot of the sort of really quite early paleo art and bits and pieces like that. But I am going to give my favorite one to Styracosaurus.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I like Styracosaurus. Yeah.
The Styracosaurus, that ceratopsid of the earlier Cretaceous, the forerunner to Triceratops, but just looked better, I think. I like
Yes.
Triceratops, but I think Styracosaurus does it better.
Just Googling something
It's a
quickly.
very pretty dinosaur, and a lot of the modern sort of paleo media like interpretations of it look really quite nice as well. So let us know what your favorite North American dinosaur is, because there is a wide list to choose from. Just thinking about it, you could have everything from Dilophosaurus, Edmontania, Boropelta. You could have Acrocanthosaurus, Saurophaganax,
You also
Camarasaurus,
have
Plotticus, Patasaurus.
your Styracosaurus reminded me of another ceratops from North
The
America. I just had to double check
Superceratops.
it. It's Medusaceratops.
Medusaceratops, Regaloceratops, Albertaceratops. You've got Torosaurus, Triceratops. You've got Pachycephalosaurus, Dakota Raptor, Utah Raptor, Butaraptor. Okay, I mean, the list is just insane. Camptosaurus, Stegosaurus. Yeah, you name it. There's a North American dinosaur for that. Maybe we'll do European or African or Australasian dinosaurs the week after or something. But
Okay.
yeah, let us know which is your favorite and why, of course, in the comments on our Facebook page. So, Aaron, have we got any emails this week?
Do you know what we have? And
Yeah.
this email comes to us with a huge caveat, because this actually came to us in November. It was while I was on
Oh
holiday,
dear.
and when I came back, it got lost somewhere. I don't know. I just missed
In
it.
the bottom of the mailbag.
It's been it's actually Drew that brought it to our attention this week that we'd missed it. So thanks, Drew. And we're really sorry that it's going to be so late. So we'll read it out. And we'll answer it for you now. So this comes to us from Chris Wilkinson, who says, "Hey guys, new listener here. I just discovered your podcast after searching through Spotify for natural history podcasts. So far, I'm on episode 5 from March of 2021. In the podcast so far, you've hinted about the fact you guys are friends and used to work in the zoos. I'm wondering if you have done a podcast yet where you give some background on yourselves, how you got into natural history, etc. Perhaps this is an upcoming cast that I've not gotten to, in which case I look forward to it. Keep up the excellent work." Well,
I
firstly,
think we did
Chris,
actually at some point.
I possibly, but first and foremost is to say we're sorry that it took from November the 6th to March the 3rd to get to your email. We have no
Although
idea why that got lost, but
basically on the fact that he started all the way at the beginning, he's probably not going to get this until sometime next year, maybe.
maybe
So when he gets to that point, yes, we apologize that we've let that one slide somewhere.
but welcome to the cupboard, Chris. It's nice to
Yes.
have you here. We hope you're still in here and still enjoying the product. But I think so. Yeah, at that point in the podcast we had hinted at it, and I think at that point in the podcast we were still,
Well, we were still
apart from Drew, we were
working
still
in the
recording
zoo,
on site in the zoo.
yeah.
And we have, I think we definitely did a live video on Facebook Live, where we went into more depth about it. But other than hinting at it in slightly more depth, I don't think we have actually explained it on the show like all that.
Well,
Do you want
do
to
you want
go
to go first
first?
then?
Do we both want to go first? Okay. Well, I don't think I was a zookeeper as long as Gareth was. I think Gareth was
Yeah, I've
longer.
been there in the past.
But I think I was just shy of 15 years, I think.
Yeah.
But I worked at a couple of local zoos, and then I went further afield. My introduction was by So basically, as weird as this is going to sound, I was training to be a pro wrestler. And to fund that, I was working 9 to 5, Monday to Friday in a factory, and I couldn't stand it. It wasn't anything to do with my passions whatsoever. I couldn't stand it, and I was doing it just so that on the weekend I could afford to go to training or go to these shows around the UK, and do that. I broke my wrist in a incident that is nothing to do with wrestling and everything to do with using stilts in the wrong conditions. And
that should just be a thing, you know. Don't use stilts in the wrong conditions.
In the wrong conditions, yeah. As a result, I decided to follow my passion for wildlife instead. Ended up doing work experience in a zoo that pushed me on to volunteering weekly in a zoo, and I was in the right place at the right time, got a job, and I've been doing it ever since. I met Gareth at my second job, in a very promising institution, but unfortunately wasn't so promising by the end of our time spent in these places. But I started off with Hoofstock and primates. I loved Hoofstock. I didn't like primates. And I wanted to work with carnivores. So that's what I kept trying to get more and more experience in, and ended up
being a carnivore.
Being involved with, I ended up as a head of a carnivore section.
For my sins as well. That's pretty much the only job I've ever done apart from working in McDonald's. To basically fund my ability to, somewhat similar to what Aaron did, actually, to fund my ability to go on the weekend and volunteer to be a zookeeper in a small wildlife park in Australia, until they eventually offered me a very low-paying job. But to be honest, at that point, I was more concerned about being a zookeeper than whether I was being paid to do it or not.
Yeah.
And then coming back to the UK, I've been to a variety of different zoos over the years, until eventually ending up as the head of an invertebrate section at the place where both myself and Aaron worked, until I was the deputy head keeper. But I was also the head of the education department, because I was the only one there who had any knowledge of dinosaurs. It also had dinosaurs, this collection. It basically allowed me to have dual passions as well: invertebrates, dinosaurs, and modern day dinosaurs. So that worked quite nicely. But I've worked with a bit of everything over the years, from Hoofstock, which has never been my passion, to primates, which depends on the primate as to which ones I prefer, and carnivores as well. But birds, invertebrates, and reptiles are where it's at for me. And that's how the two of us ended up there, as well as Drew as well.
I was going to say, yeah, Drew, so, that's where we both met Drew as well.
And I think I'm trying to remember now exactly when we started doing the podcast, but we were at the original couple of episodes. In fact, for probably the first more than a few of them, one of the places where we would record was at the zoo, with Aaron recording downstairs in the same building as me recording upstairs, so that we could record and not have any interference from the very limited equipment we had, and also, yeah, COVID regulations as well. So, that's pretty much our backstory, our origin story.
Our first episode was the 13th of February, 2021.
Yeah.
And that was the little fish with a big appetite, the kangaroo.
You know what? I might go back and listen to that one and
I do promise you guys, I was in that episode. You just can't hear me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else to add, really. But that's a good kind of summary. And then if anyone has any further questions, because I appreciate that we've just summarized more than 15 years. Well, actually, if you combine the two of us, more than 30 years of of zoological experience into probably about a 2 minute answer. So I appreciate that that's a lot of compacting. So if there's anything you want to ask specifically, please feel free. But that's how we got into natural. I mean, Gareth, like you said, he specialized in his invertebrates, and I've been out to Asia on conservation tracks. So yeah,
More so than I wish I'd have done some of that as well. Right, well, with our email answered for this week, you can indeed send those in to our email address, which is thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com. That leaves us to say a big thank you to our Patreons. Aaron?
Yep. So our Patreons, I'm not going to do a voice because I'm still suffering here.
Both of us are dying.
But we'd love to take this opportunity to thank Chelsea McKee, Connie P., Jen Greenhall and Fogtober, who are our Patreon supporters, whose continued support through that platform is helping us to do things such as, you know, pay the fuel to get down to these places like Dartmoor and look at the source of the River Tor. So thanks again, guys.
Yeah. But you can support us on various other ways. You can do that by liking, subscribing, on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode. So, Aaron, a big thank you for coming along.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thank you to Chris Wilkinson for joining us.
Yes. A big thank you to you at home for listening. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.
You know, Aaron, one does not simply confuse an African sauropod for a North American sauropod.